Looking for the God story and news of the day. My Michelle Live, news and views. Here's Michelle.
Hey, it is My Michelle Live, where we look at the news of the day, the issues at hand, the things that we care about, and we see if there's meaning in it. Interesting that I had experienced this week a show, and in the comments, even my own cousins were talking about having conservative mindset, assuming that that's exactly what I am, that it's a mental health disorder, that it's, well, expletive, and I don't have time to debate it. But I do have time to insult it. And I think that it's important to realize how our cancel culture, our culture of deny it, retract it, redact it, has raped, plundered our culture, our history, and even our diversity. Oh no, because that wasn't the effect that we wanted. How could it be? And I also have some other bad news that I think we might be able to find a deeper story to. It could be a sign that you're not able to win an argument if all you have is insults, if all you can do is use your eraser. What is that doing to our society, and how can we be better? It happens from every conceivable side of the aisle. It's a worse disease. It's a worse virus than even that dreaded coronavirus. Is there something that we can do? Well, he may not be a doctor, but he's a rabbi. Yitzhak Adlerstein joins us with a view from Jerusalem.
And now a view from Jerusalem with Rabbi Adlerstein.
Rabbi, it's good to connect with you. It's been a while, busy summer leading into fall, and what a delight to see your face again.
It's great to be back, and you had me scared for a while when you portended that there was going to be some bad news, and I thought you meant my appearance on the show.
No. What kind of introduction would that be? Really, truly. There have been some interesting news stories and commentary that have woven together to paint a picture that all of us should learn from. We had Katie Couric, which I found to be a wow piece just this last week. And you know her as the former co-host of NBC's Today Show. Well, she revealed in a memoir that she did a bit of erasing herself on air. She chose not to air some controversial comments made by Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. RBG was critical of the sainted Colin Kaepernick bending his knee during the national anthem. And she thought, No, you can't make this stuff up. Not only did she think that shone a bad light on her, she's not believing like me. She's not being exactly, I mean, I champion diversity as long as that diversity goes along with what I think. Not only was she trying to protect her, but she had later said in an interview, well, I thought, well, she was elderly and probably didn't fully understand the question. Ouch! Wow!
She was sitting on the bench of the highest court of the country while she was doing that. And she seemed to have been doing a pretty good job there. But no, she, in this regard, she was too old to be making an informed decision. We had better make informed decisions for people, whether alive or dead. That is scary.
Through history, we have seen people, let's just report this. Let's have a little spin doctoring here. And I want to cut to even a God story in this. It's one of the reasons why I think we can know that the Bible has an extraordinary level of accuracy. It is one of those books where you don't see in other religious books where the heroes are shown good, bad, and really ugly. It just doesn't happen. It really shows the diversity within our own lives of our ability to do extraordinary things and to do the right thing, but also to have such sin and shame. That is what paints the picture of a real person, not the sainted, let's just use our eraser.
And it's a remarkable tribute to the Bible, and it points to the divine authorship, the divine origin of the Bible, that either God is a miserable PR agent or really into the truth. You can rarely, if ever, find a hero in the Bible who at the same time doesn't get raked over the coals. And that's not what you do, especially to founding fathers of religions, to the greatest people in religion. Look what happens to poor Moses. You know, he's called the greatest prophet ever, and the last words of the book of Deuteronomy are that there will never be another prophet as great as him. And he's called the. He did. When in that scene when the Israelites wanted water, instead of speaking to the rock, he got angry. We're over 3,000 years from that occasion, and people have put lots of thought in it, and everybody's still scratching their heads. Like, what was the great sin? But God wants you to know that Moses did sin. You can't find heroes who aren't taken down at the same time. That's not what we do to heroes today, especially ones that we want to win the favor of adoring masses. That's too dangerous.
And how interesting. We know that doesn't work, and I will tell you why. Hollywood is a perfect example. The Marvel Universe of Thor and Loki and Spider-Man and Iron Man, that Marvel Universe has taken off like no other superhero franchise. That superhero franchise, in an era where we are looking for superheroes, we want those superheroes, and that's on our radar. We love the TV series, the movies, but in that particular universe, it has succeeded greatly, and one of the main arguments to its success is because they show the fallibility, their downfalls, what they're really afraid of. They humanize them. They give them sin. And we can relate to that because that's how human frailty works. The beauty isn't in your perfection. There's a Japanese term, wabi-sabi. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation, but it's the beauty in an old barn. It's a beauty in the cracked voice of a groom saying, I love you, to his bride, or in the shaky hand of a very old man leading his wife into a car. There's beauty in that, and we refuse to see it.
I'm reminded of the aphorism of a great Hasidic leader of about 200 years ago, who said, "The most perfect heart is a broken heart. It's not things that are perfect and that have made it to the top that really capture our imagination or even capture God's love. But it's the fact of what we can do while we are imperfect. And there's only one perfect being in the end, only one, and that's God. No one else can aspire to that. Now, the danger of what we're both talking about is that people can't seem to find an effective middle position. They either insist on deifying human beings, or they say, well, this person isn't worthy of any respect. See, on 52 years ago, he was once caught going through a red light at 2 a.m. in the morning. How can you really relate to somebody like that and never look up to him again? So on the one hand, we need heroes. On the other hand, when we find heroes that make demands subconsciously on our behavior, then we're not prepared to see them as heroes and recognize their great accomplishment. You're in no danger when you recognize the greatness of some athlete, because if you're not a tennis player, somebody being the greatest out there on the clay court doesn't really make any demand upon you. But when you're talking about heroes who are ethical and moral heroes, then unless you can bring them down to your level or even below, they are a threat to you, because they remind you that, yes, it is possible to do better than what you've been doing. Even fallible human beings can do better than we're doing right now.
I wonder if that is at the core of what has become known as the cancel culture, where we are denying other voices, pushing other people out of the picture, and just saying, okay, we want diversity as long as diversity is in line with my way of thinking. Otherwise, we demonize, we criticize, we cancel.
Well, two thoughts on that. One is that I shared with you an article that was particularly meaningful to me. It was written by Dara Horn, who's a conservative writer, very talented writer. And she actually got it printed as a guest editorial in the New York Times, which I guess every now and then has to give the impression of being sort of open to diversity, but they're really not, which is what Dara Horn's piece was about. Now, ostensibly, it was about the last Jew of Afghanistan and what a media circus had developed around him. He was a colorful character, and I'm afraid not somebody many of us would like. He kept his wife strung out for decades, why he never moved to Israel. He was trying to prevent her getting a divorce. A lot of things that were wrong with the guy. Finally, he did leave Afghanistan. All of a sudden, everybody's talking about the last Jew of Afghanistan. Now, this is not what you think, Michelle. I'm not going to talk about the persecution of Jews and anti-Semitism. We'll talk about that some other time. Dara's point was that this is true not only of Jews, but of other places around the world where cultures become monolithic, monochromatic. There's only one kind of person left. In China, it's the Han Chinese. Yeah, there are lots of others, but the Han Chinese have taken over culturally, the language. And then they start getting nostalgic about the other people who once lived here, and they build museums and they do talk shows about them. It's as if they can only tolerate people and see the good in them
when they're far
away. At arm's length.
Yeah, she when they're far it, away. You're wonderful as loves. Long as you're far away.
Right. Now, the real question, Michelle, is where does that come from? Is that insecurity? Is that because the world is on one of these train wreck rides where people get caught up with an ideology and can't see anything else? Is this something fundamental to our, which is where I think I would go, something fundamental to having lost the things that used to bind humanity together? That no longer are the case. I know there have been lots of terrible wars, and we are tribal, it seems, by our biology and our early history. But there was something about being human that allowed...
I'm not sure what that was. Ah, it was you. I'm so glad.
It was media censorship. I hate when I don't listen to my own advice about turning cell phones off before. Sorry about that, everybody.
No worries. You see, that's where we don't have to be perfect. We can show our humanity.
But there was a time when people could tolerate dialogue, when people liked listening to a debate, when you could open a newspaper and find left and right on the same page. Mm-hmm. And it was...
By the same reporter.
All right. And now that's not true. You have your cell phone filtered to download just the news sources with which you agree. And you don't pay any attention to the other, mostly because you really don't have the arguments, because we've moved to emojis and six minute YouTubes, and we've lost the capacity to really talk to each other. I know that one of the books that I recommend to students is called The Great Debate, and it's a remarkably revealing book about the origins of both liberalism and conservatism, going back to the letters exchanged, marvelously articulate letters, although they hated each other, but long arguments traded respectfully between Thomas Paine and Burke. Almost everything that's happening, you can see that happened back then. Different conceptions of what government should be like, of what the role of individuals in government should be like, of ideology versus pragmatism. And I guess because it's the God Show and I like being on the God Show, I don't have a solution for that for the entire world. But if you can't cure the entire world, you can cure your block, or parts of your block, or your community, or a group of people who coalesce around an idea, hopefully around a positive idea like God. And within that, there's still room for people talking to each other, at least.
And what happens when we talk to each other? Before our broadcast, we were talking about the state of corona in Israel. And without getting into the virus, that's another subject for another day. What we've effectively done is canceled the ability to talk about differing sides. When we do that, vaccines don't get better. When we do that, cures don't get better. When we do that, we don't really, we flounder around trying to make decisions only based on we're only allowed to think this or discuss this. And I think that has been the peril of what we've experienced for the last year and three quarters, is that our cancel culture has allowed us to demonize other ideas and voices. So if you bring an alternative voice, you are automatically labeled and canceled. And as you mentioned with Burke and Payne, our country was all the better because the Bible says, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. You get sharper when you have those sparks fly at times.
Right. You know, I'm addicted to a few things. I am an addict. One of the things I'm addicted to is the study of Talmud. And it has a lot of ancillary benefits, like making yourself feel stupid about three times a minute when you're involved with very, very complex arguments. But when you sit there and study, usually with another person who you trade insults with, yeah, how could you say that? That's not what it means. That's what Talmud study is about. But the subject material itself is always two opinions. There's rarely any agreement on an important issue. And you learn that you can only understand one position when you understand its opposite. And that is so unlike the way we live our lives today. And there's this cancel culture. I'm afraid all of us have to take a little blame for it, because yes, this is not an invention just of the last couple of years. There were so many signs that it was coming, including the composition of university faculties, in which conservative voices and the voices of people with strong beliefs about things like religion kept on getting pushed out and pushed out and pushed out, so that young people were used to getting now a monolithic, monochromatic view of all the important things they went to college to explore. This has been going on now for decades. People are at home with this now. So is it any Is it any surprise to us is that when they get a few years older and now they're running the media and being the anchors on television shows, they just continue to exhibit the same kind of pat yourself on the back. We're holy and we're on a crusade and we're going to fix the world.
True.
And what do you plebeians know about it? So it's all the same. This is what we sent our kids to college for.
But I believe that there's hope because people aren't always stupid. And we start to see the breakdown in our worldview. And then we think, is there something more? Is there a better way? And I think we do that often with looking at some of the ridiculousness of our issues. We can get angry because on May 5th, on Cinco de Mayo, people will don a sombrero and eat tacos. That's cultural appropriation. That is cultural appropriation. Right there, we can cancel it. On the other hand, if a man puts on makeup, prosthetics, gets things removed and puts on a dress, he can then play sports with other women and become Woman of the Year on Time Magazine. Why is that not sexual appropriation? Your worldview breaks down fairly quickly. And we look at the ridiculousness of it. Another one that we were exchanging on emails was we just coming out of Hispanic Heritage Month, and the idea of Latinx being of Latin descent, it is freaking baffling. Are you kidding me? I was just speaking, Rabbi, with a new friend at an Oktoberfest party who was just learning English. He came to this country and then found out that he was Latinx. And he's like, what are you talking about? The Latin people are repulsed by that. Why? Because if you have any understanding of the origins of Spanish, of Latin, of all of these Hispanic cultures and languages, you realize that their entire world is based on the feminine and the masculine. Every word is la or le, el gato, the cat, and la tabla, the table. It's feminine, it's masculine. And so you want to X out our culture because it aligns with what your ideology is. What are we doing?
As somebody pointed out the irony that this was an issue raised by the UCLA Alumni Association that hosted the Latinx Heritage Month. And some irate student wrote back and said, maybe the UCLA Alumni Association had better change its name quickly to the Alumnix Association. The ridiculous extremes that people have gone through today, I think is our greatest sign of hope, because sometimes you can only expose the ludicrousness of an argument by seeing it in sharp relief against sanity. And that is what's happening in the country today. And I shudder to think of what will happen if there's a real backlash. And we're certainly on the verge of a cultural civil war.
I think we are, and maybe an awakening. And there are ways where we have come to this, and that is maybe because of pushback. If a man is a little more effeminate, we have traditionally absolutely demonized, made fun of, and have been cruel as a society. There should be no place for that. So as you had mentioned, Rabbi, it extends the gamut. We all have a bit of this sin within us, even though we like to pretend like it doesn't exist. We like to erase it. We like to redact it and make ourselves look a little bit more like superheroes. It's a lot easier to demonize others when we're doing that.
And especially from a distance, or when they're all dead, so they are no longer a threat to our carefully honed ideas, which aren't so carefully honed at all, which is why we're insecure about debating their principles and tenets with anybody else. I'm less optimistic than you are, though, Michelle, about whether we can recover from this. I'm afraid you're going to have to agree with me on this, at least I suspect you will, that I don't know if there's really in society today for any recovery other than in communities that still have a strong sense of a God who speaks to man, who makes demands upon man, who legislates for man. There is room among people like that for saying that the most important thing in our life is this mystery that dwells within us and the next person as well. This image of God that is there and that is holy.
Yes.
There's some hope. Not that religions have not done a great deal in getting rid of those that they didn't like either. The call that came through that you unfortunately heard because I hadn't turned off my representative of the largest Black conservative church in the world. We're good friends. He lives here in Jerusalem. He's now the bishop of Jerusalem and Israel. Was a part of the Southern Baptist Church, but it was a long time ago, like that today. But at the time, the idea of Black people joining white churches was just so horrific mm-hmm. to church leaders that Black people started their own churches. So there's a lot of bad that can be done.
I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, where my parents grew up, and I saw the church where we went to church, and across the street was this little shack, and that's where the Hispanics were allowed to worship. The ugliness of division and racism, we can point it out when it comes from one side, but now we are going back to segregation from a whole different side. And you know what the problem is? We get back to what you mentioned, and it's the God story. I wrote a song called Hate is a Virus, where I say, we're not satisfied till we weaponize everything that used to be civilized. We can no longer have civil discussion, in other words. And my conclusion is we need grace, faith, and love. The God story is vital in this, because when we realize that we all carry this burden of sin, but we also are created, as you mentioned, in the image of God, suddenly heroism, overcoming, tolerance takes on a whole new meaning. Rabbi, is it true in your opinion that where we see a recognition of God in a society, that we do see more tolerance? I mean, I think I know the answer, but maybe we could get into the whys.
The whys, I think, are very simple. No great revelations here. The image of God can be carefully disguised. It's not always so easy to see. And sometimes it's very difficult. And it takes work for us to be able to close our eyes and to see something that is deeper inside the person, or to recognize that the humanity of a person is itself a gift of God, and that there's a divine spark within us. A great Hasidic leader of a few centuries ago, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, advised that with everyone you meet, you find something positive in them and frame your internal reaction to that person around this one thing that is admirable. And it is not so difficult to do that. There are people who will make it a little tough, but generally, if you're open-minded, you can find that. And if you do, when you have your eyes open to every encounter with a human being is an opportunity to grow. There's something that I can learn either directly from the person or about my own reaction, about whether it was the right reaction, it was the wrong way of approaching things. These are the most important encounters that shape who we are. And for those of us who believe in eternity, we take what we've done in this world with us for eternity. So it's a remarkably powerful tool, having religion in which you take God seriously and you see God present in the image of others. It also means, though, that as we lessen our connection with God, it's very easy to not see the image of God. Or if you're an atheist and don't believe in God in the first place, well, then there's nothing out there other than another person sharing the biosphere with you that happens to be the only creature that has evolved to the point that he can destroy everything else on Earth. So it becomes much, much harder to have this relationship with others. It becomes much easier to be one of those people who said, I think in reaction to Schiller, the great German poet, remember the poem that Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the fourth movement, which everybody else, da-da-da-da, you know, that was set to Schiller's Ode for Joy. And he talked about the embrace that embraces all of mankind. Beautifully poetic image. But people retorted, there are people, unfortunately, who love all of mankind and hate every person they come in contact with. How do you go from that, boilerplate, almost meaningless slogan, embrace everybody, everybody's great, everybody's entitled to X, Y, and Z, and go from that to making a difference in the lives of other people. There are people who can do it. You don't have to be religious to do it, but it sure is a lot easier to do it when you firmly believe in God and you approach things the right way, not using God as your sixth gun to get things done, not using God as a tool to grant you the things you want or to stay out of hell. That's not what God is for. God is a being who is everything, who is all things good. It's the source of everything. And our job here is to understand him more and get, even as human beings who can't get anywhere close to what he is, but to understand the commonality. The commonality is there, but it has to be looked for. And when you look for it in yourself, you're going to find it in other people as well.
That's the God story that maybe we can all take. It's so very easy in our world to tribe up. And that's a lot of what we're doing. It's an extreme tribalism. We find people who are like us, and then we create social media that presents algorithms that gives us more of what we like. And there really is psychologically and physically a reaction, a kind of a dopamine that rises up. We like that. That's like I think, and I don't like that. That doesn't make me feel good. When we do that, we become more of a feeling society, and then we are more given to logical fallacies that, well, this feels right, and if it feels good, do it. It causes that spiral. And I would argue that the hope is in everything that you just presented before us. It's not something we can put in the water, though, but it is something that we can inoculate ourselves with. And that is the thought that you were created in the image of God. You were created to be a magnum opus of God's creation. You are unique, spectacular, fearfully, and wonderfully made. You are, as an image bearer of God, something that I should respect and have value for. And when I do, I may not change the entire world, but I certainly change my world and everyone who comes in contact with me. I'd like to give you the final word.
As a great lab exercise in developing these feelings, I'm going to give an unvarnished pitch for my favorite city on earth, Jerusalem, and say that as of November 1st, it's now official, tourists after a year and a half are going to be allowed in this country again, at least those who are vaccinated, sorry. But we do expect people to come, and I sort of beg of all those who love this country, who love what it's meant for humanity, to defer your next vacation to Nepal, which is a great place to go, but give people here a break. We need to kickstart the economy. There's still tens of thousands of people who rely on this industry, but when you do, and you travel the length and breadth of the country, and you realize who was here before, and you can feel the presence of God walking in the street, it may be the single best thing that you can do to understand that image of God and to bring back that understanding to the States when you return.
The stakes are high. A lot of our society and our own lives depend on understanding that God story. If it's real, it's certainly worth investigating, isn't it? From Jerusalem itself, our beloved Rabbi, Rabbi Yitzhak Adlerstein, thank you for being with us today.
More news and views at MyMichelleLive.com.